Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this session of Azure Networking Deep Dive. I am Sally Mahamdeh, and I'm here with my team, with Christoph and Richard, who are our networking partner sales executives, and with Federico, who is also a networking pre-sales engineer. I'm going to do a very quick introduction of this session. Just a quick reminder for those who are joining us for the first time. We are the sales specialists and we focus on networking and we cover Europe, Middle East and Africa. And the goal of this series is to help you better understand the way networking works in Asia and how to plan and design connectivity in the Microsoft Cloud. Also, this is a monthly call, so we will be having it every month. Let me take over as presenter. I think somebody modified the slides. So we will be having this every month. We had a first call in October. For those of you who did not join, we have a recording, and the recording is available on Channel 9. So please feel free to watch those recordings. In terms of the format, we will have a business overview that will be covered either by Richard or Christoph, and a technical overview that will be covered either by Federico or myself. And for the audience, customers, partners, people from Microsoft, you're all welcome to join. So our first session was in October 25th, and we covered, we gave you an overview of Azure Virtual Networks. Today we are going to cover a subject that a lot of customers asked us to work on, which is how to secure virtual networks. And in December, we will have our last call for this calendar year, and it will be about inter-VNet connectivity. Of course, we will have another calls in January, between January and June. I will share the calendar for those with you on our next call. If you would like to receive an invite for December 13th call, and you are not part of the list of today, or you would like us to share this with your customers that are not in the list for today, just send me an empty email and make sure the subject is Azure Networking Deep Dive Invite, and I will invite you to those calls. And the recordings. I have received a lot of emails since October asking for the recordings. So the recordings are available on Channel 9. You can either look for the series by typing Azure Networking Deep Dive, or you can just go through this link. The agenda for today. We will have a business overview. Richard will cover a real-life networking story, and then Federico will walk you through the different features that can allow you to secure virtual networks. A quick reminder, this call is recorded, so if you could please mute your mics, that we make sure that the recording is as clear as possible for anybody who would watch this later. So yes, please mute your microphones, and if you have any questions, just put them through the IM window. I will take them during the conference, and also we will take some time at the end for Q&A. And this is it for the introduction. Richard, are you here? Would you like to take over?
Thank you, Sally. I'll take over as presenter now. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. As Sally mentioned, I'm the partner sales executive for ExpressRoute in EMEA. So my role is very much working with our partners and customers like yourselves to help customers on board when it comes to networking. So seems like the slides are moving around a bit.
Yes, I think somebody took over as presenter. I'll take care of this, move them, and it should be okay. Yeah, okay.
So yeah, whilst Sally's doing that, we're just going to get those slides up and running. But the customer I'm going to talk about today is going to be HarperCollins Publishers. So I know some of you guys may already have ExpressRoute, or you may be thinking about ExpressRoute. And really what we want to do in this session is talk to you about a customer we worked with a couple of years ago now who implemented ExpressRoute, and how it became a very, very much an integral part of their move to the cloud. Sally, are we all good now?
Yes, we should be. Let me check.
Looks like those two slides might be missing.
Let me check.
So Sorry about this, guys. A little technical hitch here. We're just getting going.
Okay, let me take care of this. I'm going to upload the deck with the slides on the story, and then I'll move to the other deck. And I will make just one single presentation and will upload it on Channel 9. Sorry for the inconvenience.
No problems.
Okay, so almost there. Okay. And let's move directly to the story.
Yeah, sure.
We're there. And then I'll switch to the other slides.
Great.
Thank you.
Sorry about that, everyone. So, yeah, as I mentioned, I'm going to be talking about HarperCollins Publishers today. For those who aren't aware of who HarperCollins Publishers are, they're one of the largest publishers in the world. Got a customer size of 850 employees, should I say. They are owned by News Corp, which is one of the largest news corporations in the world. So, like a lot of businesses, they came to us a couple of years back and were challenged with the issue of trying to do more with less, as I'm sure a lot of you guys are as well. And they started to look at the cloud and with a main focus of removing their physical data centers. And they were particularly attracted not only just to the cost savings, but also the flexibility that cloud had to offer. So I'm sure that mirrors a lot of your guys' thoughts. Their parent company, News Corp, basically gave them a 3-year project to move the majority of its data centers to the cloud, and they, in parallel, were actually moving their London offices, so it was very much a logical time to start investigating the cloud and a number of the providers out there. Now, their parent company, News Corp, actually uses all three of the major cloud vendors, so Azure, Amazon, and Google. However, HarperCollins actually chose Azure, which we were very happy about. And their main rationale behind it was the fact we had a very good raft of features that fulfilled a lot of their demands. Some of the functionality we had, they think, stood out. And also, you know, our focus on constantly evolving the platform and our future plans. So they felt that it was a future-proof environment. One of the biggest concerns, however, that they had was in order for them to consume cloud services, they wanted to ensure that the performance of accessing those services remotely was as good as what they were getting today. And that was something that was very, very much at the forefront of their mind. And that's why we started talking to them really about ExpressRoute. They wanted a far secure and reliable link between their employees' computers in London and where they the Azure data was sitting in our Dublin facility. And we actually talked about a number of options, and ExpressRoute came out on top every time. And really for them, it was about the fact it was private and it could offer that predictable performance. enabling them to move and access their main business applications in Azure. To give you a little bit of an idea of the sort of applications they were moving across, it was a 25 terabyte digital asset system, a Reaper graphics system, a procurement system. All these applications are obviously, you know, real-time critical applications to the business, and they wanted to ensure that their employees would have a good experience when accessing those applications. Now, some of the benefits they found, obviously by shifting their data center assets into Microsoft, was, I think I touched on it a couple of times, but it was the predictable performance and the fast connectivity. Being based in the UK, it was able to deliver that consistent application performance to its London-based employees, while also reducing IT costs. And I'll go to examples of where the IT costs came from later. One of the interesting things they actually said was that without Express Route, they would not have been able to make the Azure hosting practical for its London employees, and that's how critical it was to their business. One of the major savings for them was actually historically when they were running their data centers on premise, they had to constantly pay for and manage 25 to 30% over capacity on their in their physical data center, and that was an ongoing cost that they had to pay, whether or not they used that capacity or not, it was still a fixed cost. This was one of the things that they were able to get rid of when moving to Azure, and they managed to recategorize that IT spending from a capital expense to an operating expense. You know, this was something that was really key to them when they looked at the solutions in the beginning and their business need. It was about doing more with less. And this was one of the very quick, easy wins that enabled them to get rid of additional costs and use that resource for better solutions to drive the business forward. As well as the cost, they also enjoyed the flexibility of being able to use compute on demand, ramp up when they wanted and ramp down when they didn't want to as well. So again, this is just a very simple example, but I think it's one that really resonates with Express Route and shows the power of actually how much good connectivity can have an impact on a customer's decision. Now, before I hand back over to Sally, I wanted to end with the final slide. Let me just take over as presenter. With this final quote, so obviously it's all good and well us being from Microsoft and telling you guys how good Express Route is, but this is an actual quote from the head of infrastructure for News Corp, and I will read it out, and obviously you guys can read it as well. But he focuses on, he says, if you're going to run your enterprise in the cloud, you need an enterprise-grade network or connectivity. Express Route enabled us to connect to Azure in a controlled and managed way with high levels of security, quality of service, and bandwidth. We found that enterprise-grade systems do not function properly beyond 20-30 milliseconds latency. With Express Route traffic from our London office to Azure in Dublin, it's about 40 milliseconds round trip. So the employees using our applications do not notice a performance impact. And I think if I can end on one thing, I think that the key value prop we always see with Express Route is really around that predictable performance. So as you make your journey to the cloud and future applications move to the cloud, we want you to feel comfortable in the fact that you will get that predictable performance. So thank you guys for taking the time to listen to this story today. We have a full case study on HarperCollins. If you are interested in it, please do contact Sally or myself, and we can obviously send you guys the link to the full case study so you can read a bit more about that. Sally, thanks a lot. I will hand back over to yourself and let Federico give us some of the technical elements.
Thank you very much, Richard. That was great. Federico, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Yes, let's move to the technical part now on securing virtual networking.
Okay, so as Sally mentioned, today we are going to cover the different features that the Azure platform makes available to secure virtual networks. I would like to start with this high-level picture that you might have seen already. It is actually part of our public documentation. The purpose of this picture is to explain that workloads that you deploy within Azure Virtual Network are protected by several layers, several security mechanisms and countermeasures. Some of those are natively and transparently provided by the platform. Others are features that are optional. Those features are there for you to use and configure depending on your specific security requirements. In this presentation, I will go over most of these layers. Starting from the outer layer, the first security mechanism that is always there to protect everything that you deploy on the platform is the set of anti-DDoS mechanisms implemented by Azure. Those are something that as a user you don't get to see or touch. These mechanisms are managed on your behalf by Microsoft. They are applied to the whole Microsoft network, and we use those mechanisms to protect the entire spectrum of cloud services that we offer. Those mechanisms are basically based on two aspects. The first one is the ability to detect when a DDoS attack is initiated against one or more endpoints belonging to the Microsoft network. The second part is a set of automated mechanisms that are triggered when detection has happened. Those mechanisms can, in an automated way, detect the traffic that is generated by the DDoS attacker and change the way that traffic is routed within our network in order for that traffic to be sent through scrubbers. And after the traffic has been properly scrubbed, the good traffic will be sent back to the original endpoints. As a result, in most cases, customers will not even notice that they have been targeted by DDoS attacks because the underlying network will prevent and mitigate those DDoS attacks in an automated way. One thing that is important to understand with respect to DDoS is that those mechanisms, as I mentioned, have been designed to provide protection for the entire Microsoft platform. So while they are very effective at detecting large-scale attacks, which target typically layers 3 and 4 of the ISOs networking stack, they might not be as effective in identifying specific DDoS attacks that are mounted at the application level against the specific application endpoints exposed by our customers. For this reason, you as a customer are still responsible for deploying additional DDoS countermeasures in order to protect your own application from application level DDoS attacks, which target the your application specifically and not the entire platform. Well, let's now move at the second layer, endpoints. What do we mean by endpoints? Well, the moment you deploy an application on the Azure platform, you have several ways to expose that application to the public internet if you want to do so. The first thing that you can use in order to expose an application to the internet is using the Azure Load Balancer. The Azure Load Balancer can work in several different ways. Let's have a quick look at what are the key features and functionalities offered by this service. First of all, as its name implies, the Azure Load Balancer can actually be configured in order to distribute requests coming to a single virtual IP address to multiple backend instances. And the load balancer will implement transparently for you a round-robin algorithm whereby different requests will be sent to different backend instances. you can decide what kind of persistency to have. You can decide whether you want a persistency based only on the IP address, both on the destination side and the source side, or if you want to have a session affinity for based on IP addresses and TCP or UDP ports. The second way you can configure the load balancer is by using the so-called inbound NAT rules. When used in this way, you can use the load balancer to expose one single VIP and to direct ports connections coming to those port to those VIP over different ports to different backend instances. The typical scenario for this feature is the ability to configure the load balancer for exposing behind one single VIP multiple endpoints of applications running on backend instances. For example, if you want to use the load balancer in order to provide access through one single VIP to multiple RDP endpoints behind it, you can use inbound NAT rules as you see in this slide. Finally, even if you have one single backend virtual machine, you still use the load balancer, although you don't do it in an explicit way. The platform will do that transparently for you. Well, you can use the load balancer to expose the behind the public IP address one single virtual machine. And in that case, the load balancer will forward any connection coming to the public IP address on any port to the internal IP address of the virtual machine and the SIM port. Another feature that allows you to expose in a secure way endpoints to the public internet is the application gateway. The application gateway is a service that implements load balancing and some security features at the application layer. First of all, you can use the application gateway to perform SSL termination and SSL offloading so that you will be able to expose SSL sites by using one single certificate and avoid deploying that certificate on multiple backend instances. One other thing that the application gateway offers on top of the basic load balancing features offered by the Azure Load Balancer is the ability to implement session affinity based on cookies. Also, the application gateway will allow you to implement multi-site hosting. So you will be able to expose multiple sites, either HTTP or HTTPS, behind one single VIP. The web application gateway also implement URL-based routing, so you will be able to configure different pools of backend machines behind the application gateway, and based on the URL of the HTTP or HTTPS request that is received by the application gateway, you will be able to route that request to a different set of backend virtual machines. Of course, just like any load balancer, the application gateway is able to continuously monitor the health status of the backend virtual machines in order to decide which one are up and running and should receive traffic and which one are not up and running and should therefore be excluded by the load balancing algorithm. The application gateway creates detailed logs as JSON formatted objects which can be written to an Azure storage account and then analyzed either directly or by means of third-party security incident and event management platforms that you might be running on your premises. We have recently announced that a new SKU is available for the web application gateway, whereby the application gateway is able to provide additional security features. More specifically, the web application gateway can work as a web application firewall. The web application firewall functionality can be activated during the provisioning process of the application gateway. And the moment you activate it, you get immediately the ability to either detect or block any request that matches well-known attack patterns. The type of attacks that the web application firewall is able to detect is based on the top 10 vulnerabilities that have been identified by OWASP, not-for-profit organization, which works on web application security and monitors what types of attacks are trending and what type of attacks are most common in the public internet. Now let's have a look at what happens when the traffic, for example, coming from the internet actually enters a virtual network in order to reach your workloads. First of all, a virtual network provides isolation. The moment you create a virtual network in your subscription, you get from the platform a completely isolated the logical network that will host your virtual machines and will provide connectivity across your virtual machines. Given that the moment you create a virtual network, you get a completely dedicated and isolated environment, you will be able to select which IP address space to use for that virtual network. You are free to decide whether to use RFC 1918 addresses or to use public IP addresses that you own. The moment traffic enters your virtual network, you can then use network security groups in order to decide which type of connections can reach your virtual machines. Network security groups are an access control list-like feature. And in this slide, you see the key things that you need to know in order to use network security groups. First of all, network security groups are a list of rules, and each rule is a five-tuple. A five-tuple that is used to match connections and then to decide for each connection whether that connection should be either allowed or denied. Each rule, the five-tuple for each rule is based on source IP address, destination IP address, source port, destination port, and protocol. When it comes to protocol, the options that you have for matching traffic are TCP, UDP, or ANY, which actually means either TCP or UDP or ICMP traffic. As I mentioned, for each rule, you can specify an action, whether allow or deny. In a network security group, you can define rules for both directions, either inbound or outbound. Network security groups work on a priority basis. Each rule that you define within a network security group will be assigned a priority that you can control. The lower the value is, the higher the priority of your rule. The moment you have a network security group defined containing several rules, each time a packet is processed by the network security group, that packet will be matched against all the rules included in the security group, and the first rule that matches the packet will be used to decide what should happen to that packet, either if the packet should go to its final destination, or the packet should be dropped because it is part of a connection that is not allowed. The second important thing to remember about network security group is that each rule that you define in one of them is stateful, which means you don't need to explicitly define rules for return traffic. To give you an example, if you want to define a rule to allow HTTP traffic to reach one of your web servers, you simply need a rule for traffic from any source going to a specific IP address, the IP address of your web server, a specific destination port, port 80, or any other port if your web server listens on a non-standard port. And you are not expected to define a rule for the traffic leaving the web server in order to go back to the client that created the request to the web server. Each network security group can be applied either at the NIC level or at the subnet level. For inbound connections, the subnet level network security group will be evaluated first, and then the NIC level network security group will be evaluated next. For outbound connections, the order is reversed. So for each packet leaving a virtual machine, the NIC level network security group will be evaluated first, and then the subnet level network security group will be evaluated next. This is a picture that you can use in order to remember what I said about the order in which different network security groups are evaluated. As you can see here, the moment traffic enters your network in order to reach a virtual machine in it, the traffic will first go through the subnet level network security group, and then through the and then to the NIC level network security group. For outbound traffic, the order is reversed. I will not comment in detail this slide. I wanted to have this slide here for your future reference. This is the detailed algorithm that is used by the platform when evaluating a packet against the list of rules defined in a network security group. In a nutshell, what these algorithms explain is what I have summarized before, talking about priority for rules. Each network security group contains several rules. The moment a packet is received, the packet is matched against the rules, and the first rule that is found to be matching will be used to decide the fate of the packet. When you create a network security group, that network security group will be created by the platform with some default inbound rules and some default outbound rules. Those rules are always there and cannot be removed. However, those rules will be created with the minimum priority, which means that every custom rule that you add to a network security group will be able to override the default behavior which is implied by the default rules. In terms of default inbound rules, what you will have when you create a network security group is, first of all, a rule that will allow connections between any two virtual machines in the same VNet, and will allow connections coming from the load balancer and going to your virtual machines. The reason for having this default security rule in place is that you want the load balancer to be able to probe the health state of your virtual machines in order to decide whether to send traffic to them or not. The last rule, the one with the minimum priority, is the deny all rule, which is used in order to prevent any other type of connection unless explicitly allowed by your custom rules that will that you will add. In terms of outbound rules, it is important to remember that a network security group will contain a rule that will allow any virtual machine in the virtual network to connect to the internet. Of course, this is just the default behavior. If you don't want this to happen, you can simply create another rule that will prevent your virtual machines from talking directly to the internet if this is what you need. Last thing about network security groups, when you define your own custom rules, you can use the so-called default tags. Basically, default tags are shortcuts for set of IP addresses. Most typically, the default tags that you use are virtual network, which is a shortcut for all the IP addresses contained in your virtual network, Azure load balancer, which is a shortcut for the address used by the load balancer to originate the probe requests, and then internet, which means everything outside the address range of this virtual network. When designing network security groups, it is important to keep in mind some limits which you need to know in order to decide what is the most effective strategy for your network security groups. First of all, you need to remember that you can associate at most one network security group to a NIC, and you can associate at most one network security group to a subnet. In each subscription, you can have at most 100 network security groups in each region, and you can create at most 200 rules within one single network security group. Finally, I want to remind you that in the Azure portal, we have recently made available a new feature which is extremely useful for debugging issues when working with network security groups. If you have a virtual machine, that virtual machine will have a network interface card associated to it. If you select the network interface card, you will see that you will be able to see the effective security rules that are applied to a specific NIC. And what you see in the right-hand side of the screen is the set of security rules which are applied to the NIC as a result of a combination of the subnet-level network security group and the network interface card-level security group. Another important feature that Azure Virtual Networks make available in order to control how traffic is managed and routed within a virtual network are user-defined routes. The moment you create a virtual network in Azure, that virtual network will be associated to a system route table. The system route table is what defines the default behavior for a virtual network. The default behavior for a virtual network can be summarized by three families of rules that you see in this slide. First of all, as I mentioned before, the moment you deploy a virtual network in a virtual machine, that virtual machine will be able to talk to any other virtual machine in the same virtual network. And this happens because in the system route table, you have one or more rules, which are the so-called local VNet rules, enabling exactly that type of intra-VNet communication. Then, as we have covered in the previous sessions, you might decide to connect your virtual network to your on-premises network, and in order to do so, you can use either IPsec tunnels or ExpressRoute connections. The routing rules which take care of traffic leaving your virtual network and going on-premises, or coming from on-premises and entering your virtual network, are called the cross-premises rules. Finally, as I mentioned before, virtual machines in a virtual network will be able by default to talk to the internet unless you define network security groups which explicitly prevent this. This behavior is due to the existence of the third type of rule in a system route table, which is called the internet rule. Basically, this rule acts as a default rule, which will route to the internet any traffic that is not going to other virtual machines in the same virtual network and is not going to an on-premises network, either to an IPsec connection or through an ExpressRoute connection. User-defined routes are the ability for customers to add additional routing rules to the system route table and to override the default behavior that I have just described. By using user-defined routes, you can implement some useful scenarios which have a direct relationship with the ability to implement in a virtual network the security policy that you want. In order to explain this, I will take two very common use cases. First of all, user-defined routes allow you to use virtual appliances. So virtual appliances are additional virtual machines that you might want to deploy in your virtual network in order for them to implement some security-related networking functionalities, for example, firewalling. In this slide, you see two virtual machines, VM1 and VM4, which in the default scenario are able to talk to each other directly. However, you might want those virtual machines not to be able to talk to each other directly, but you would like the traffic going from VM1 to VM4 to be filtered by a firewall. This is exactly what you can achieve by using user-defined routes. By using user-defined routes, you can define a custom route table for the subnets where your virtual machines live and modify the default behavior of those subnets in such a way that traffic leaving VM1 and going to VM4 is not routed directly between the two virtual machines, but is actually forwarded to a virtual appliance, as you see in this slide. A second very common use case for user-defined routes is the ability to modify the way a virtual network routes cross-premises traffic. By cross-premises traffic, I mean all the traffic that either originates from an on-premises network or goes to an on-premises network over an IPsec or an express route connection. In order to understand why user-defined routes are useful in this scenario, let's first have a look at what would happen if you didn't use user-defined routes. So in this case, we have VM1, which needs to communicate to an on-premises host, and you also want the traffic originated by VM1 to be filtered by a firewall in virtual appliance before being sent on-premises. So what you see in this slide is the path that the traffic from VM1 to on-premises would follow on the request path. Now, the moment you would receive the response traffic from the on-premises host, what would happen is that this traffic would traverse the internet over the IPsec tunnel, or it could be the same if you had an express route connection. This traffic would hit the VNet's VPN gateway, which would terminate the IPsec tunnel. And the moment the traffic coming from on-premises is decrypted by the VPN device, the traffic would be routed directly to VM1. Clearly, the issue that we have in this case is that for your firewall in virtual appliance, it would not be possible to see and to filter appropriately the response traffic. As you see here, while the traffic originated from VM1 gets filtered through the virtual appliance, the response traffic just goes directly from the VPN device directly to VM1. So you can use custom route tables in the gateway subnet in such a way to modify this behavior and to make sure that traffic leaving the response traffic leaving the VPN appliance after decryption is actually sent to the virtual appliance before reaching VM1. And in this way, you ensure routing symmetry and you make sure that your virtual appliance will be able to see not only the traffic leaving VM1 for on-premises, but also the traffic coming from on-premises and going to VM1. As I mentioned, this would be exactly the same for Express Route. So let me recap some important facts about user-defined routes. User-defined routes are three tuples. Each user-defined routes is defined by an address prefix, which is the range of destination IP addresses for which you want to modify the default routing behavior of the subnet. The second element is the next hop type. You can use tags here. The available tags are either virtual network, meaning that for the set of destinations defined by the address prefix, you want the routing to be direct. Virtual network gateway, meaning that for the set of prefixes included in the first element, you want the traffic to go to the virtual network gateway. or virtual appliance, which means for the set of prefixes defined by the address prefix, I want the traffic to go to a virtual appliance. You also have a tag of known, which you can use to black hole traffic that you want to completely remove from your virtual network. If you use a tag of type virtual appliance, of course, you also need to specify what is the IP address of the virtual appliance, and this is what the next hop IP address is for. This is, of course, used only in the case the next hop type is of type virtual appliance. The second important thing to remember about user-defined routes is that they work based on the longest prefix match criterion, which means if you have several rules, either default rules or custom rules in your route table, the rule that will be applied to a packet is the one that will most closely match the destination IP address of the packet. In this respect, there is a critical difference with respect to what we have seen with network security groups. Network security groups work based on priority. You have several rules. Those rules are ordered according to a priority that you define, and the first rule that matches a packet is the rule that decides the fate of the packet in terms of firewalling. With user-defined routes, you can have several rules, several routing rules in the table. Rules are not ordered according to a priority criteria, but the rule that will be applied to each specific packet is the rule that will represent the closest match of the destination IP address. You also have in Azure a concept of weight. The moment you have multiple rules in a route table which have exactly the same prefix length, then the platform will decide which rule to use based on the priority criteria that you see here. So first of all, the user-defined routes will be used. The second criteria is the routes that you learn over BGP, either for ExpressRoute or IPsec connections, and the third place is for default system routes. There are a couple of things to remember when using user-defined routes, especially if you are used to working with physical on-premises network. First of all, route tables in Azure are assigned to subnets, but they are effectively applied to traffic leaving the NICs based on its destination address, which means in Azure you don't have exactly the same behavior that you would have by defining gateways that define the routing behavior for the entire subnet they control the traffic for. Again, it is important, just like it is the case for network security groups, to remember what are the limits, the platform limits for user-defined routes. For user-defined routes, you can define, you can have at most 100 custom route tables per sub and per region, although this limit can be increased up to 400 by opening a support ticket. And within one single route table, you can have up to 100 custom routing rules. Again, you can contact the support to have this limit increased from 100 to 400. Very similarly to what we did for network security groups, we have added to the portal the ability to see what are the routing rules which are effectively applied to a network interface card. Again, if you have a virtual machine deployed, you search for the network interface card of the virtual machine, and the moment you select it, you will be able to see a menu item called effective routes, whereby you will be able to see all the routing rules that are applied to the traffic leaving that specific NIC. Now, in the last 10 minutes of the presentation, I will and some more words about network virtual appliances. So as I mentioned before, network virtual appliances are virtual machines that you deploy in your virtual network in order to implement networking features which are most typically related to security. So you might want to deploy NVAs in order to have your custom firewalls or to have your application firewalls to include intrusion detection or intrusion prevention capabilities in your network to perform load balancing in custom ways, or even to terminate IPsec tunnels without using the platform provided features. There are two key things in Azure that are needed in order to allow you to deploy network virtual appliances in a virtual network. We have already spoken about user-defined routes, and we have seen how that feature is critical in order to modify the way traffic flows in a virtual network and to make sure that traffic between two different virtual machines in a virtual network can be sent through an intermediate network virtual appliance in order for it to be filtered. The second important feature provided by the platform that is critical to support network virtual appliances is IP forwarding. IP forwarding is a simple switch that you enable for a virtual machine when you create it, and that is what enables a virtual machine to process traffic that is not destined for itself. This is what enables a virtual machine to work, for example, as a firewall and to receive traffic which is actually meant to go to a final destination, which is not the firewall itself. So when you decide to deploy network virtual appliances in Azure, you have several architectural options. The first choice that you need to make is whether you want to deploy a virtual appliance with multiple network interface cards, or you want to deploy virtual appliances with one single network interface card. This is something that is definitely different between on-premises and the cloud. In physical networks, security-related devices such as firewalls also have several network interface cards whereby they are connected to isolated broadcast domains. In the cloud, this is not strictly necessary, and you can implement an architecture like the one that you see in this slide. You deploy your network virtual appliance in a separate subnet, and then you create user-defined routes in the subnets that you want to exchange traffic through your network virtual appliance. In this case, you see that in order to have traffic between virtual machine 2 and virtual machine 5 filtered by the network virtual appliance, you have to define custom routing rules in both the subnets. Basically, the user-defined rules for subnet 1 will define that all the traffic going to subnet 2 has to go through the network virtual appliance first, and in a very similar way, the user-defined routes for subnet 2 will basically say that all the traffic going to the virtual machine in subnet 1 must be sent to the network virtual appliance before reaching its final destination. The second option that you have is to deploy network virtual appliances with multiple network interface cards. And in this case, you don't need to deploy the virtual appliance in a separate subnet. You can actually deploy the virtual network you can actually attach the two or more network interface cards of the virtual appliance directly to the subnetworks that you want the network virtual appliance to filter traffic for. So in this respect, you can create an architecture which is similar to what you would do in a physical on-premises network. However, you would still need user-defined routes in both the subnetworks in order to make sure that traffic leaving one subnet and going to the other subnet is not sent directly, but is actually sent to the network virtual appliance in order to make sure that the traffic is properly filtered. The most critical consideration when using network virtual appliances or native features provided by the platform is high availability. The key advantage that you have when using native security features provided by the platform, such as network security groups, is high availability. All of the features that I have described in this presentation, when they are native features provided by the platform, they are inherently highly available. The moment you decide not to use those native features and to implement them by using custom virtual appliances, then ensuring high availability becomes your responsibility. It is possible to deploy network virtual appliances in Azure in a highly available scenario, and there are actually two approaches to do this. The first one is to use an active-passive approach, whereby you deploy two network virtual appliances in a separate subnet, and you define one of them to be active. In this case, the two network virtual appliances must define some custom logic in order to monitor each other in such a way that if the secondary appliance detects that the primary is no longer working, for example, because it has gone offline, then the secondary network appliance can update the user-defined routes in a proper way. So basically, what should happen is something like this. The primary network appliance fails, the secondary network appliance detects that the primary is no longer working. Because of this, the secondary network virtual appliance modifies the user-defined routes in such a way that traffic is no longer sent to the primary NVA, but is actually sent to the secondary NVA. And at this point, the failover will be complete and the virtual machines in subnet 1 and subnet 2 will be able to talk to each other again. The second approach is to use an active-active approach. In this case, what you do is you define a couple of, you deploy a couple of virtual appliances and you create an internal load balancer for distributing traffic across the two instances which will be working at the same time. The only caveat that you have here is that in order to be sure that each instance of your network virtual appliance will receive the return traffic corresponding to the requests that went through a specific instance, in order to do that, you need to implement source nutting within the network virtual appliance. What happens in this case is the load balancer will distribute by using a round robin like algorithm traffic across the two instances. Each instance will source NAT the traffic with its own IP address so that the return traffic will always go through the proper instance. In this case, the advantage that you have is that you don't need the two network virtual appliance instances to monitor each other and to modify the user-defined routes when one of the two instances will go down. The reason is that this work, the work of monitoring the health state of the of the network appliances, will be done on your behalf by the load balancer. And the moment one network virtual appliance goes down, the load balancer will simply stop sending traffic to it. So in this case, so this is a summary of the active-active scenario. As I said, the key point to remember here is you need to use SourceNAT. As of today, the key limitation that you have with, that we have in this case is that only traffic for selected ports can be managed in this way. And the reason is that when you configure a load balancer, you have to define load balancing rules which are specific for each port. In the future, we will release new functionalities for the load balancer that will allow us to implement this scenario in more general and effective ways. And with this, I will hand back to Sally for the closing of the session. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Federico. There's just one question that was asked by Greg, and I think it would be great if we took just some time to answer it. And it was about UDRs. So Greg's initial question was about whether UDRs will override a system-defined route to a remote subnet configured in policy-based site-to-site VPN.
Yes, they will. User-defined routes are always take always precedence over anything that is created in an automated way by the platform, for example, as a consequence of configuring an IPsec tunnel. Of course, in order for a custom-defined route to take precedence, that route must be more specific than the route created in an automated way by the platform.
Great, because that was the other question. So what if he creates a UDR on a VM side of a network appliance that uses a 000/0? He asks if he would need a more specific subnet route for the remote VPN subnet.
Absolutely, yes. That default route will never be more specific than anything else. So it will not take precedence.
Okay, great. One last question because we have to close the call. So from Russell, can we move VMs between VNets or is this still unsupported?
Correct.
Still unsupported. Okay, thank you so much.
It really depends on what you exactly mean moving virtual machines between VNets. If you mean moving virtual machines without shutting them down, yes, it is currently unsupported. Of course, it is definitely possible to shut down a virtual machine, take the disk of that virtual machine and re-provision the virtual machine on a different subnet. But that will come with the downtime.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Greg, Russell, I hope this answers your questions. If this is still unclear, please feel free to email us and we can take this offline. Everybody, thank you so much for connecting to this call. Our next call is in December, and it's going to be about inter-VNet connectivity. The recording of this call will be available on Channel 9. Thank you so much, and talk to you again in December. Thank you, Federico. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. Bye-bye.